Well, the head of the Defence Force, Rudzani Mafanya, has gone to Iran, caused all types of chaos, and William Sanderson Mayer, author of Jaundiced Eye, which is the longest running political column in South Africa, has got some pretty good insights in it, including a lot of fresh issues. He published that in Politics Web this week. But we're going to go one step further. We're going to try and find out who General Mafanya really is and perhaps apply some second-level thinking to discover what his motive is. William, really good to be talking to you again. The tribe loves our discussions and loves your contribution. But let's start off with this strange thing that happened. If you look at it from the outside and you observe as a neutral, you'd say, what the F is this general doing? Who is he? How can he do something like this? Excepting when you go and look into this guy, he's quite a lad. First of all, he was the commander of the biggest post-apartheid battle that South African forces have had, what is called the Battle of, which I never remembered, I actually never even knew that it happened, the Battle of Bangui, where 27 South Africans died, but 200 of them fought off 7,000 rebels. So he's a man. Secondly, he's of the same grouping that Cyril Ramaphosa is. His name, his surname in Venda, if he were Zulu, which is where you and I kind of understand a bit better, Mafanya, that sounds like young boy. But Venda, it means to crush, to smash. So he's quite a lad there. And then he's also been busy in Mozambique. He was in charge of the military that got rid of those Islamic insurgents. So he's got a very strong record. He almost jumps out at me as the army's version of Mkhwanazi. Mkhwanazi saying, I'm the police guy who's going to fix South Africa. I'm tired. I'm hot full of these politicians. And here you've got a guy who does something designed to show that he's hot full of politicians. And he knows where the bodies are buried. That Battle of Bangwani is still very... it happened 12 years ago, but it was the death of South African forces to protect South African business interests. That's the allegation. Of course, the government said it was different, and Zuma said, no, we weren't there for that. But it's been very well documented by investigative journalists here in South Africa. So it's a fascinating story, and you had some very interesting insights, fresh insights that you published this week. But let's just start from the premise, from the possibility that just like the rest of South Africans are hot for with the politicians, maybe the guys in the military feel the same way.
Well, the background you sketch to the general, it's very interesting in the sense that, as you say, he is a made man. He is in that position not as a token performer, and he comes with a credibility which makes his statements in Tehran far weightier than one would. This is not a lightweight move by him. And it fits very much into the what I would argue, this is no rogue general. So the talk that's going around, this is a rogue general, he stepped out of line, he can simply be smacked on the wrist or dismissed. That is clearly not possible. I wasn't aware of the extent of his credentials, but it adds weight to the dilemma that Ramaphosa finds himself in. He's not a rogue general. This happened with the agreement. That visit took place with the agreement of the military, and he has the backing of Andy Mochega, the Minister of Defense. It could not have taken place, whatever Ronnie Lamola now says, it could not have taken place without the awareness of Durka. It's simply inconceivable that the two would not have liaised to some degree on where he'd be going, who he'd be seeing, and what the import of what the potential diplomatic fallout of his statements are. So he is what was said in Tehran, basically committing South Africa to a military and political alliance with Iran, which is an extraordinary statement. If he were a rogue general, he would have been dismissed already. He would have been cashiered, and he would have come back in leg irons and handcuffs. He hasn't, and he won't. From what you're saying, he then is virtually unfireable. The country is... Mkhwanazi's actions in KwaZulu-Natal, taking on the Minister of Police, as you say, saying we're tired of the politicians, has rocked South Africa. It has created it has highlighted the fragility of the country, how easily it may tip. This coming on top of that, yes, adds to that uncertainty. It is an indication. I don't believe he's saying that he's tired of the politicians. I think he is the steel jacket nose of the bullet behind a set of politicians, which are already have strong influence in Durko. I don't know what the gap is between the Islamist faction in Durko and the old ANC people like Lamoa, but certainly there is a strong Islamist faction in Durko. And now we have clear indication that there's a very strong Islamist faction in the SANDF and maybe an untouchable faction.
He sounds untouchable to me. He knows where the bodies are buried from the Battle of Bangui, where 27 of his forces, he was involved in the action. He was the overall commander. He wasn't the operational commander. That was a Colonel Dixon, William Dixon. We got heroes everywhere, and we just don't even know that they exist. But anyway, there were these. The story is fascinating. There were 200 South Africans sent to the Central African Republic, ostensibly on a to look after the president, and so that the coup didn't happen. The president then was attacked by rebels who broke an accord. There were 7,000 of them who advanced on the capital. And these 200 South African troops kept them off for a couple of days, 3 days. And the president then gapped it because he was going to, the coup was going to happen. And then presumably the general Mafanya went and negotiated a ceasefire with the rebels. The South Africans left, but they'd already lost a number of, well, the most people that South Africa's ever lost in a military confrontation since then. So that's kind of the one part. Now just my suspicious mind. They were sent there to defend the president. There are South African interests, many of them, of politically connected people in the Central African Republic, or there certainly was at the time. So he knows where the bodies are buried, i.e. people close to the ANC. Plus he went up and handled those Islamist insurgents in the Cabo Delgado province in Mozambique, very well known. It stopped the Total a plant from going forward, which is the biggest investment, can transform the Mozambican economy, but it's not going to happen. Again, the allegations are that the politicians were using that as a trade route for illicit goods, and as a consequence of that, it had become open. Now, the interesting thing is that the troops have gone. Our troops are out of Mozambique. They only left at the end of July. So there's another potential sparking point there, given that the Mozambicans couldn't protect themselves before. So where do they now? But the second point with this general, he knows where the bodies are buried. He will know all about what the politicians have been doing in Mozambique. He just sounds to me like a hard-assed military guy who said, I've had enough. These bloody politically connected business people, in inverted commas, are killing my people. They're making us protect them. And actually, they are living high on the hog. And I just feel that maybe there's a lot more to this story than meets the eye, because, as you say, nothing could have caused more trouble right now than exactly what he did by going to Iran at this point in our history.
It highlights how weak Ramaphosa is at the moment. He is unable to act against the general. If he were able to act against, he may well yet be forced to act against the general, but I just don't see it. Either Ramaphosa knew about it, and it seems to me incredible that such a visit such a high profile visit. We mustn't forget he met three people in Tehran. He met,
tell us about that. Tell us about that and the relevance.
He met the head of the army. He then also met the chief of the armed forces. And then the third meeting was with the Minister of Defense. And then he spent a lot of time at the military college talking about the possibility of exchange of officer training programs and combined research and development. This was not a courtesy visit. He opened his remarks in his visit by saying, "I bring you greetings from the Minister of Defense, Angie Motshekga, and the President of the Republic of South Africa, Cyril Ramaphosa." I mean, he's taking the name. If this was an unauthorized visit, he is. What could be more provocative than to use those words? He also said, "This is not a military visit. This is a political visit." He used those words. Well, I paraphrase them roughly, but those are the words he used. So he went to Iran on a high profile visit, which we are now supposed to believe was completely unauthorized. You speak of the bodies that are buried in the DRC and wherever the ANC's economic interests lead it in southern Africa or in the continent of Africa. But there are also lots of bodies buried in Iran. South Africa has strong links, and those links extend to the president. MTN faces four suits, civil litigation suits in the United States, about its alleged involvement in supporting the Iranian military forces, especially the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, against American interests by providing it with technological aid and leaking information to it, which enabled it to kill American servicemen in Iraq and in Afghanistan. Now, those suits have initially the MTN tried to get them dismissed. Very recently, it was decided that they wouldn't be dismissed, and they've been cleared to proceed. Who knows what will come out in that discovery process? Those suits link right back to when Cyril Ramaphosa was the chairman of MTN. MTN is still, in the past week, there's been announced a grand jury investigation into MTN's involvement in Iran. So the stakes are getting higher and higher. There's a process now unfolding within the courts, and when a grand jury investigation, that comes from the Department of Justice. So pressure is being exerted from within the American government against South African and specifically ANC involvement in Iran. And they are going to be casualties to that process. Now, I don't know how that fits in with the general's visit, but whether it is a deliberate act of provocation to say to the United States, if you are going to pursue this, you are going to push us closer and closer to the countries you don't wish us to be part of, or alternatively, it's an act of provocation by those strong Islamist forces within foreign affairs and the defense force, saying, this is the moment. Let's push it to the edge. Let's spark that confrontation. There's a lot of revolutionary theory that moves around that idea, but there's always a moment where you provoke it. You say, bring it on. And a lot of that rhetoric comes out from the ANC at the moment. You know, Fikile Mbalula's beating his chest in public and saying, bring it on, we can take it. We will never betray our revolutionary ideals. So there are bodies buried, as they may be in the DRC, and as they certainly are in the DRC, there are also bodies buried in Iran. And some of those bodies, I believe, are quite close to our president.
Yeah, so this Battle of Bangui in the Central African Republic preceded the DRC that you've been referencing now as well. And I suppose overlaying all of this is that the general turned 65 in November. So this is his moment to make a statement. And I suppose he's not really, if he has to retire in November, he's not really going to get another chance to do as much damage from an economic perspective, but as much support from a revolutionary perspective as he can right now. William, we never talk in South Africa about military coups because, of course, we're a constitutional democracy. But you've got to start thinking that the risk is growing when you get this kind of news breaking from the head of the Defence Force, and then that comes on top of similar news breaking from a very powerful person in the South African police services, where they just disregarding what the diplomatic approach is, or what the what, if you like, the constitutional approach would be from the country as a whole.
Yes, the criticisms of Mkhwanazi were, why didn't he follow the chain of command and bring take his complaints through that chain of command? Well, of course, the response would be, he didn't use the chain of command because the chain of command is deeply compromised, and many of the people whom he would have to move through that chain of command are actually people who are corrupt. I don't know to which degree the ANC is, the SANDF it continues to provide cover for ANC business interests, but that is certainly a possibility. If the general is about to retire in November, it should be easy then to say to him, well, bring forward your retirement, you need to go now. Whatever, there are murky things happening in the background. I think it's quite interesting that when the DA's national spokesperson on international affairs, Emma Powell, resigned, in her letter, she said South Africans have that in her movement, in her job through the continent, she became alarmed by the degree to which the interests within the ANC and within South African officialdom are linked to rogue figures and rogue regimes around the world. Now, that's code, I think, for links between the ANC and the Iranians, without a doubt. I can't say without doubt because it's not overtly stated, but that is what I would draw from her comments. She's bitten the dust and out she goes. The key to me is, whatever the ramifications and web that is spun behind what is unfolding now, we're in a dangerous moment. We are in a more dangerous moment. And what is interesting is we seem to be unaware of how dangerous the moment is. We have a general who is contradicting the president. The president says it should not have happened. I didn't know it. Now, I don't know if we can still believe our president. I mean, he lies often and quite brazenly. He's been called out by two judicial commissions, one the Zondo Commission and second the Fala Commission, who said that the evidence to be delivered to both those commissions were at times incredible and unlikely, and they stopped short of calling him a liar, but to all intents and purposes, they called him a liar. So it's very simple possible that he's lying about this. If he is not lying, if the general has acted beyond his remit, Ramaphosa has to act. It is the survival then of our democracy, in a sense, because if generals can do such things, the next general will also do it. It's not going to stop with this one performance, and it's a slippery slope. The next, we're heading the Zimbabwean route. Cyril Ramaphosa doesn't have a lot of courage, and unfortunately, the DA within the GNU has no route into DIRCA, the International Affairs Department, nor into the Ministry of Defense, nor into the state security apparatus. So all the most crucial and powerful departments within government are a closed book to the DA. So it cannot exercise a true unity role within that government because it's been excluded from the most important levers of power. And it unfortunately means it also it doesn't attack as it should be. The DA should be desperately concerned about what is happening here. It's not enough to say to this is unacceptable, the general must know. They need to know why they didn't know about any of this.
You know, I keep thinking back to a man I admired greatly and in a way called a friend, Frederick van Zyl Slabbert, if he was the leader of the DA in this government of national unity, how different he would have reacted to the way the DA has been doing it. Because in this way, it's your government that is now, you're part of this government, and you have to take joint responsibility or do something about it. But I'm going to close off with something that both of you know, both of us know quite well. The Oyster Box in Mkhlanga is a genteel, fabulous place that the Tolman family own as a part of their hotels around the world. But it's become a very different hotel to the one that I recall. Still charges six-star prices, but I have a friend who spent a couple of weeks there recently, and he was informing me that it's been taken over by armed thugs from the police services and from the taxis. Now, when Paul O'Sullivan was interviewed on BizNews TV about Mkhwanazi's failings, as he put them, he said that the unit that Mkhwanazi heads were spending many of their evenings staying at the Oyster Box at 10,000 rand a night. And it was one of those things that kind of just got mixed. My friend says to me, these guys don't order doubles. They order triple Johnny Walker Blues. Whether they put cream soda into them or not, I guess is still a moot point. But it does appear as though there's a heck of a lot happening to which we are being blindsided until we actually get to see it up front. As they say, strategy goes out the window when someone smashes you in the face. It does appear as though there's something that we, the people in South Africa, are just not understanding at the moment. And if we try and apply some second level thinking, you did say in your column that this is a very dangerous period that we're at. And as you mentioned a bit earlier, maybe the most dangerous time that we're in. So you used descriptions of chilling. Where is this likely to head to? Where could it head to? And how can we react or prepare ourselves for it?
Well, the worst scenario to my mind is a continued slide towards what's happened in virtually every post-liberation African state, a slide towards a despotic government, authoritarian government. If our slide to that relies on the actions of Cyril Ramaphosa and John Stiernes, and I don't have a lot of hope to prevent that slide. But I think you've made an important link which I haven't thought about before, and that is the one between the police and the defense force. Because when you there are no heroes, Mkhwanazi, I doubt, will turn out to be a hero. He's very likely as compromised as the people that he's taking on. What is happening in the police is a battle between factions now. If you add in the SANDF as a third disintegrating source of South African security, then we are really in a very difficult situation. And I honestly don't know how one prevents that. What one needs is a very strong civil society response, an outraged media, an angry response from the NGOs, who at the moment are more fussed about how much hot air is going to be expelled at the national dialogue and who gets to expel it. We sleepwalking at the moment. Maybe what will change it is some sharp, short reactions from the United States, some sanctioning, some more punitive responses from the U.S., because I think that seems to me the direction in which the U.S. is going. I think it's patience is wearing out. But the trade issue is irrelevant almost. What was lay behind the U.S.'s actions were concern about where South Africa is moving in terms of its international alliances. This, for the Iranian visit, accentuates that and aggravates it. And now, as you say, we at the same time we have a disintegrating and uncontrolled police force. Police force can't even react to the taxi companies. It doesn't, because it's tied into them as well. It's a very, very worrying situation.
And if you want to see it close up, just go and look at the Oyster Box in Durban, and you will get a very, very sad reflection of one of the consequences of this republic of no consequences. William Sanderson Meyer is the longest writing columnist of a political column in South Africa. You can rejoin this eye on Politics Web, and I'm Alec Hogg from biznews.com.